Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Six Feet Under, Season 2, Episode 5, The Invisible Woman is over, but we're just getting started here on Post-Show Recap. That's right, it's the Six Feet Under podcast. We are revisiting the critically acclaimed HBO series episode by episode. I don't know if you heard, my name is Ariel, and I am joined by my invisible woman. It is Amanda. Amanda, and I am telling you,
what? I'm not going. The show tunes. Oh my goodness. Yes. Yeah, Ariel, not a lot of people know this because they're used to just hearing my voice, but I actually do not possess a physical form.
This is incredible. This is probably like the biggest con in all of podcasting.
This is breaking news.
All of time. Amanda, no corporeal form. Amazing podcaster. 10 out of 10. We love it.
I am a disembodied voice. So really, podcasting was my calling, I think you can say.
There was a thing in BoJack. I'm not going to get it right, but it was like they were describing someone and it was like a something body of like anxious longing and something, like instead of a corporeal form, that's all it was. Anyway, we digress. We're here to talk about a different invisible woman, not you. Stop making it about you, Amanda. It's The Invisible Woman, directed by Jeremy Padeswa, written by Bruce Eric Kaplan. Amanda, I don't know about you. I found this episode to be effing hilarious. Like, I was dying laughing for so much of it.
This is a funny one. There's a lot of great moments here. This is also like some really heavy moments in this episode.
Of course, of course.
Yeah. But
we can't have one without the other.
No, not in Six Feet Under, at least not with this cast of characters. This one, there were definitely a lot of funny moments here. We have Brenda's little journey. We have Claire and Parker, who are always a riot. Rico cracked me up in this episode.
He's like reached his breaking point. It's so funny. Everyone's
this
like,
man.
Everyone is either hungover or like at their wit's end. That's basically the story.
Yes. Lots of very good stuff here. And I was so delighted to see my beloved Adam Scott here, a little baby Adam Scott.
This is crazy. I didn't think that Severance season 2 was going to be tied into Six Feet Under. This is wild. This is like the biggest smuggle.
It's in the same universe. It's all
in
the same
universe. This is second only to the news that you're actually invisible. The fact that Adam Scott showed up on this Severance season 2, Six Feet Under season 2. It's perfect.
And you know what, Ariel, I think after we finish Six Feet Under, we need to recap Fish and Coop coming this fall on ABC.
I love the music that I heard. I didn't see a lot. Well, I didn't see any of it. None of us did. But from what I heard, it sounds like a smash hit for the fall. It's so old school. It's like that old school. Maybe they would have played it on Friday nights back when Friday nights were actually a thing on the broadcast network.
Let's bring it back. Let's bring back network television. Let's bring back must-see TV.
Must-see TV. What was Friday?
TGIF.
TGIF. That's right. Family Matters.
The good old days.
It did matter. Okay.
There's actually a lot of the good old days. This is a very 2002 episode. And what was it? It was like the Temple Grandin reference.
I wrote it down immediately. I was like, this is an incredible moment. Like the cross section of all these random things. Clearly, David watches movies. He's the big movie head in the family.
He loves musicals. Show
I appreciate
guy.
It. Yeah, yes. Loves musical. Loves watching Claire Danes play Temple Grandin. I'm sure he was a fan. All right. I think it's time to get into our quick plot recap.
Let's
so we can
jump
get
into
all
it.
Of this stuff and get hugged by the plot, just like Temple Grandin herself. Okay, here we go. Welcome to Nightmare Fuel for anyone who lives alone. That's me raising my hand. Emily Previn chokes to death with no one around.
I would find you, Ariel. I would not let you lie there.
That's, the sweetest thing you've ever said to me.
I will find you. If you choke to death.
Also, I was thinking I really need to Google how to like Heimlich myself, because I know it's not as easy, but it's possible. And under those circumstances, you don't have a lot of time. So you just have to go.
You have to know. You can't Google in the moment.
No, you can't Google. You're going to turn. Your phone is going to fall just like her glass of water did. That was awful. Not to worry, though, because she already took care of her arrangements. Jeff, that's so morbid. For her funeral services. Problem is, she has no friends or family to speak of that are still alive or interested in attending, and that sends Ruth and Nate on a mission to give her the funeral that she deserves. Ultimately, it's just the Fisher family and Rico. At her funeral, Ruth takes this opportunity to tell her children that she doesn't want to end up like Emily, and she wants intimacy and reads her children for filth. She's speaking fiercely from the eye with the filth. And Ruth, this is Ruth rebuilding her foundation. You go, Ruth, says Jess. Brenda is writing an effing book because of course she is, and she decides her life isn't interesting enough. So she invites the sex worker massage client who we'd met previously to lunch, and it's really to get all the gory details on the occupation of her client. And that's not enough even there, because she offers to be her client's watcher for this one particular client who needs a third person to watch what they're doing.
I didn't know this was a career option, Ariel.
I sit at home sometimes doing nothing. I could be making money sitting doing other things.
Those would be billable hours, Ariel. That is billable hours.
Allie Lasher has never been prouder of you for saying that. Brenda, so she's the watcher, and that's, if you watch Fringe, it's a completely different thing. Brenda will do anything to feel something, clearly, including proposing to Nate when they're obviously going through something with the ring that she found when she was cleaning, and it wasn't even like her ring. The whole thing was bizarre. Nate says yes because when Brenda's involved, he makes bad life choices. But also because, you know, we'll get into it though, because that scene is interesting. Meanwhile, Claire is prepping to take the SAT. I was thrown back in a tizzy back in time, Amanda. This is crazy. Which is every high schooler's nightmare. Yes, agreed. She freaks out when Parker cheats on the SAT by sending a different person who isn't her to take it on her behalf, and says that she's and then Parker also says when she confronts Claire that she is going to have sex with Claire's guidance counselor, Gary, who apparently has great buns. I disagree. Gary decides the best. I mean, listen, if you're standing next to Nate, it's no contest. Gary decides the best thing to do is to bring up that there is sexual tension between him and Claire. For my money, this is the first mistake he made, and I can't wait to talk about it. Why do the men in Claire's life suck? All right, finally, David goes on a date with Adam frickin' Scott of Severance himself and many other things, like Parks and Rec, etc., which I've actually never seen. That's on me. I've seen the first season. Anyway, even gets
Watch
to make
party
out
down
with
too.
Him.
Watch Party Down.
I know. Oh, yes. Party Down. I have seen the first season, actually. Okay. And even gets to make out with him. Keith who? Well, I'll tell you Keith who, because Keith is having a terrible day.
Oh,
as I'm
goodness.
Laughing, I'm like, okay, this is actually really serious. He is a police officer and he shoots someone, and it's poor David who is left in the lurch. First, he has to like be there for Keith and consummate this. This is the real sexual tension that Gary was picking up on between him and Claire. It was just transference from David.
Sexual tension by proxy.
By proxy, exactly. They spend a night together seemingly, but David wakes up, Keith's not there, and David is left in the lurch. And then Keith says that they can't be friends anymore now that he's gotten what he wanted. Oy, what an episode.
I was so fired up about how Brenda is the worst, but now I'm more fired up about how Keith is the worst.
I love when we get like a shiny new worst object
yes.
that we can like fix it.
Dude, well, I mean, first of all, like, not a laughing matter at all. We have a moment of unnecessary lethal force by Keith, which is terrible. When this scene started and you have like the couple and they're on drugs and it's a white woman and a black man, I was like, oh, good Lord, no, not 2002. And then Keith ends up shooting this person. It's terrible. It's like, you know, police violence is, you know, something that can we continue to be in a national trauma about. Yeah. So, I mean, like, you know, the show goes there, and this is interesting to see this through Keith's eyes, but this whole episode is a rough look on Keith. Like, we've Absolutely. Pointed out before, like, the way that Keith is using David as, like, surrogate, emotional support, boyfriend when it's convenient, and then pushing him away in favor of his relationship with Eddie when it's not. He's been toying with David, and now he, like, ratchets that up to 11 by coming to poor sweet David after he is, you know, rehearsing his holiday cards with Adam Scott, like, who's adorable, like this, you know, public defender, which is the opposite of a cop. So, like, we love that.
That's true. Yeah, I didn't really think past the just
the beta blockers.
No, I was blocked by the beta blockers. I knew he was a lawyer, but I didn't think through what the kind of lawyer he was. That's a really interesting point.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, David is for the first time, like, able to be in a place where he's moving on in a healthy way with somebody that we're all really excited about, even though we probably have figured out right now that Adam Scott is not one of the stars of 6 Feet Under. But
damn it.
God damn it. But yeah, like, David's ready to move on. And then Keith swoops back into his life, has sex with him in a moment of weakness. And, like, yes, like, Keith is under a lot of stress. And then immediately, in the most, like, sanctimonious Keith way, is just like, that was a mistake. I can't hang out with you anymore. Bye, David. And, like, David's just like, whatever you want, Keith.
Yeah.
So
I mean, credit to David, at least in that moment, for being like, yeah, sure, whatever you need. Like, he's so clearly, yes, disappointed in what Keith did, but, like, feels taken advantage of and is correct to be a little bit indignant about it. Mm-hmm. But obviously he's trying to be sensitive to what Keith was feeling, and that was all very serious. And but this is all I want to place part of the blame on David a little bit, because I will never forget, and I will never stop bringing it up, because it was simultaneously so hilarious and so sad when we talked about David being like, I don't have anything to do. Yeah, I'll follow you all day. Like, this is what happens when you do that. Like, when you become
this is why you have to build a fence. You have to have strong walls.
You can't just have an open lawn. Then dogs will come.
You need a lock on your door.
Did you lock the door, Amanda, before we started to pod? I just want to make sure, because Brenda was very
No, my house has a lot of structural integrity.
I so appreciate how sure you were of that. And it's really sad, but, like, this is basically where we thought this was going to end up. But obviously, because of the circumstances, it's in some ways, like, the worst case scenario of where this could end up because of the circumstances that led Keith here. But it was like, this highway was only leading to one exit, and
now we're building roads.
And now we're houses, listen,
it's a whole city,
country. It needs infrastructure. Like, it's
This is the infrastructure bill. Yes, it's an election year, 2024. Infrastructure.
This is all I'm saying.
We're my infrastructure girlies.
I'm a fangirl of infrastructure. It's sad, like I said. And even though this is like where they were careening towards, it's unfortunate. And it's crazy, to your point, like, the timing of it, of David finally going on this date, seemingly really liking this guy, being unable to lie to this guy. We have seen David at times be, like, vaguely Brenda-esque with his lies and how quickly they come to him. And here he was like, wait, no, I can't kiss you because I have been dishonest. It was so cute.
Yeah, their date was really cute. And, like, obviously, you know, David is really scarred. Like, when Ben says he has to leave, David's like, oh, yeah, there's no spark. I get it. Like, I've been through this before.
That was so bad. Oh, no, it's because the last guy burned me so hard that I had to, like, be one step ahead of you. I'm sorry.
And then Ben's like, oh, but I thought there was a spark. And then David's like, yes, please, spark.
Yes, please. I don't have anything to do today. I will follow you around. Adam Scott.
Yeah. So, you know, we do get, like, when David is in the, you know, in the post Keith dumping him part of the episode, David has a headache. He's lying down. He's like doing like the ultimate depressed post breakup posture of like lying in bed when the phone rings, when somebody comes in, he's like, Keith, is it Keith? It's like, no, not Keith. Keith is gone.
That was crazy because Keith already told you he was gone. And then somebody shows up and you're like, Keith, did you come back? No, he didn't come back. He just broke up with you a second time, even though you weren't even together.
But he does have a call from Ben in that episode. Like, he does have a call from Ben, like saying like, hey, I want to hang out on Saturday. So I hope he does. I hope that they continue to see each other.
Yeah, I want to look up Adam Scott's like total episodes in this
I know
season, but I don't have a lot of hope because...
I know it's not a lot
because of the situation. And again, it's like all about, and this is something that happens in real life all the time. At least it's happened to me. Maybe I'm the David of like, sometimes it's just the bad timing and you're like, oh, if we had met like 6 months before, 6 months later, a year, whatever it is, if you had worked through your issues, yada, yada, or me with mine, I can own them. Things would have been different, but now I don't know if I can be with you when I have suffered this like emotional fallout of being broken up with, again, like a thing that was, we weren't even together. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. Like Keith is also dealing with some other tough stuff in this episode. He like Taylor is staying with him now, and that's hard. At some point he says like he hears his father, his first instinct is to get angry. Keith doesn't have like
the get angry.
We see him get angry. And I think like, you know, Taylor is difficult and she's going through a difficult time. There's been a lot of upheaval in her life. So like everything that she's doing makes total sense to see from a child in this situation, but it's also really tough to deal with. So Keith has a lot on his plate. Eddie is like not very supportive.
Eddie sucks, at least in this one scene. Like, first of all, shout out to Keith being way too real with Taylor. And she's like, I'm not tired. I'm just going to sit in bed.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
Like, yeah, you'll lie there for hours and hours and think about life. I was like, whoa, Keith, this is so real.
You'll lie awake wondering why life is so hard. That's what the rest of us do.
That's what the rest of us do. No, don't tell her that. She has to discover that on her own. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then Eddie thinks it's so interesting. Like, I guess when you think about, right, like the way in which the parallel in which in this moment he's feeling a certain way and Eddie goes to be intimate with him. At first I thought I was like, oh, Eddie's kissing him. That's sweet. No, Eddie, you're getting the wrong message. It is not like sexy time right now.
Yeah.
Be, like, hug him, console him, be there for him, talk to him. He's talking to you. Don't like try to have sex with him and then feel rejected when he doesn't do that. And then later, Keith, that's all Keith wants. He wants to have sex, although with David, not with Eddie. So that's interesting. Yeah, sorry, Eddie. This was not the play. You've been voted out.
No, not a good look for Eddie. Eddie's like taken lots of L's lately. Taylor doesn't like him. He looks in the mirror too much.
Which is crazy because we know he has bad depth perception. So like, what does he see when he looks in
Maybe
the
that's
mirror?
What he's doing. Maybe he's trying to see like, how close is this mirror?
He has to learn mirrors. It's a whole thing. God, Eddie, poor Eddie.
How ableist of Taylor.
Taylor doesn't know.
All right, now I'm ready to talk about how Brenda is the worst. Ariel, I cannot wait to read this book that Brenda is writing. Oh my God. It's going to be
She's
so good.
She's probably going to call it something dumb like sexworkers.com or something. Just like so stupid.
Manconnection.gov.
Of course, right? It's very official. I love Nate talk. Oh God, it's so interesting and tragic. Their conversations across the episode, like when he's in the way, she's like, I need to get back there. And he's like, say, excuse me, say, I need to get in the fridge. Like, why are you being weird? He's not being that weird by talking to you and standing in the kitchen. He has to stand somewhere. And like, for you to be like, oh, you're in the way. Like, clearly it's a metaphor for how she feels like he's kind of like in her way in some way, whether she realizes it or not. But it's so sad to watch them going through that when, like, yet again, all these days are passing in this episode of Nate not telling her what's going on.
Yeah.
And we see him in the beginning have his, like, you know, he's taking his pill. He's clearly not feeling great. Mm-hmm. And I just hate watching them both go through this. But ultimately, it's usually like, oh, Brenda, you kind of suck.
Yeah,
there's a little bit more.
There's so much distance between them. And like Nate tries to at least like ostensibly be supportive. And he's like very interested in her book. At one point she says it's fiction. And Nate says like, that's so ambitious. I love it. I hope I'm in it. I've always wanted to be thinly veiled.
Let me tell you, Nate, some of the shit you do is already very thinly veiled.
So like your wish has come true. But him saying that's ambitious is probably like one of the most Brenda things he has ever said. Uh-huh. Like it was so interesting to
it's
watch.
It's such
him
a backhanded compliment.
Yes.
It's like, oh, you're doing such an ambitious thing. But the subtext is like, you're never going to pull that off. Like,
wow. I'm so surprised.
Yeah. Aren't you biting off a little more than you could do? Like, Brenda mm-hmm. has already backed out of several of these like creative endeavors of hers. But you know, when Nate says he hopes he's in the book, she says, you might be in it if you ever do anything interesting.
This was just like, what in my mind had he, and I could be wrong, and please tell me if you feel differently, but it's almost like she wouldn't have been that severe with what she said had he not said the thing about, had he not like used the word ambition.
There's like a little bit of like aggressive subtext running through all of this. Yeah, and like, you know, and Brenda sees it because she also knows she's bullshit. Like, so that's what she's extra defensive about it. When she sits down to write this book, mm-hmm. it's like nothing comes to her. What do you have to say that hasn't been said before? All you do is observe yourself. You're incapable of anything real. So like Brenda is really grappling with what we've noticed all along.
We have no issues with depth perception when it comes to Brenda.
No, 2020 vision here. And who does this, Ariel? I found this like so pretentious. The poking at your keyboard with a pencil.
It's so, yeah, it is very like, I don't know, like not even professorial. It's like something like a librarian would do when they were like searching for something. Like, but yeah, it's so,
like
even
like,
in
I'm
that.
So intellectual, lying.
Exactly. And performative. Like even when she's alone, she can't help but like put on a performance for no one, for herself, because mm-hmm. she would probably argue she bores herself. So she needs to do something about that. But it's not, the one good thing is you probably hear the click clack less, right? With the eraser. It's like
a little
smoother.
Oh, with the eraser. Yeah, I mean, your fingers are pretty soft, too.
The way you just held up your fingers, you're like, wait, but what about these? Wait,
Ariel, do not spoil my corporeal form.
And now they're gone again. Wow. It's crazy how you do that.
Yeah, but all of this basically leads to Brenda needing to distract herself with something new. And what's better than Melissa, the sex worker and client of Brenda's, who Brenda is just dying to know more about this woman.
Yeah, I remember, like, it was so clear when we first met her in that, I think it was 2 episodes ago at this point, mm-hmm. When we first met her client, and it was just like, Brenda was so thirsty to like know mm-hmm. more about that part of her life and thought she was so interesting and edgy, like to the point that we both made just now a little bit about Brenda. Like she sees this person as so much more interesting than her. Like, wow, you lead a life that must be so whatever XYZ thing that she imagines what the sex lifestyle would be like.
Yeah, she really like romanticizes it. Like it's about empowerment. There's no shred of victimhood with you. You know, you really own this. You provide a service that you're well compensated for. And like,
I'm surprised she didn't say you're so brave for doing that.
Yeah, it's like really kind of fetishizing of this woman's like actual life. And, you know, and Melissa does say it's like, yeah, I used to have that feminist rationalization, but now I'm just more honest about it. And if I could get this much money for doing anything else, I would.
Yeah, she's a realist about it. Mm-hmm. She's trying to be. And the way Brenda's face falls so obviously when you just said her name, Melissa is her name. Mm-hmm. When Melissa's like, oh, everyone just always wants to ask me all these questions. And Brenda's like, damn.
Damn, that's what I wanted to do. Question after question, like I'm some sort of freak.
Yeah. And Brenda's like, oh my God, not me though. But so obviously that's what she wants. Yeah. And she gives her three questions. Thankfully, like Brenda
genie.
Is at least.
It's like a genie. You rub the genie bottle and you get three questions.
Brenda would be the worst genie. Can you imagine you rub a lamp and Brenda comes out? You'd be like, oh, hell no. Get back in there. I don't want this.
No. Run away. Yeah, in this lunch, Brenda also does open up about how she's feeling about her relationship with Nate, which is kind of the first insight mm-hmm. we get from Brenda's perspective. She says that, like, you know, she loves him, but she feels separate from him. Right. At some point, he became less present with her. Sometimes she thinks it's because she doesn't give him enough to be present for, but then sometimes she thinks he's not present because if he was, she would leave him.
This is crazy. Like the fact that it doesn't enter her mind that there's something else going on with him is, I mean, I guess tells you everything you need to know yeah. about her in a way, or at least as far as this relationship, because she can't take her. She is always, and we always talk about this, she's always centering herself in yeah. everything in her life, especially in her relationship with Nate, to the relationship's detriment, where like she could just ask him one day, hey, you've been acting weird. Is everything okay? But God forbid they should have like an honest conversation about right. their emotions. That would be too much for her to face.
Right. And this is like the very first time that I saw this parallel between Brenda and Ruth, because later we're going to have this conversation like where Ruth has her little outburst. Can't wait mm-hmm. to get to that. Those mm-hmm. are always fun. But Ruth is very much like, I demand intimacy. Nate, you've been walking around like a zombie. And it's like, well, maybe ask him what's wrong. Like, maybe he's not doing that just as a personal affront to you, Ruth. Maybe he has his own internal life. Oh, I'm sorry. He has his own house and his own room.
The shingles. You know, David had shingles one time.
But it's very much like Brenda is saying, like, oh, Nate isn't present with me. And it probably is all about me. Like, there's mm-hmm. no interest in what, and he's tried. Like, he's, yeah. you know, he's not perfect. And I'll be the first to point out when Nate is being a butthead, and he often mm-hmm. is, but he's doing something, whereas she's doing nothing in terms of trying to foster that connection.
Yeah, you can tell he's like making an effort in whatever way he feels like he can and feels comfortable enough and vulnerable enough with her to be doing. And you know, your mileage may vary on whether you think it's good enough, whatever. But she just can't get out of her own way. And the Ruth point is a really interesting one, because it's like you're using all your detective skills and then you're just stopping. Like you're like, I have all these clues. Okay, that's it. I'm just going to put the clues up on the board and not try to make any connections between them. It's sad. It's so sad. It's like very human, as we always talk about, especially with the Fishers. It's like, it's so cute. None of them are, mm-hmm. for the most part, with a few exceptions, none of them are monsters in their right. like actions and what they do and their decision making. But like, you just want more empathy, just a little bit more. You're so close. It's mm-hmm. easy to say that, like, we're like, you know, omniscient in a way as viewers, but like, Ruth, you stop paying attention to your house for long enough to notice that something is wrong with him. This is your son. Please ask him what's wrong.
We'll get back to Ruth, but before we leave Brenda, we have to get to the big moment at the end of the episode. Ariel, congratulations, Nate and Brenda, on your engagement.
This is wild. I don't remember this happening, and the scene starts and I'm like, wait, where is this going? She's at, like, is she joking? She found the ring. Like, the way that they are both kind of so unsure, very mm-hmm. obviously unsure, I should say, and not really saying, I mean, at least not really saying how they're actually feeling. She talks about the ring and how she found it and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, wait, did you actually just ask him to marry you? Yeah. This is me in the scene. And then she mentions, I forgot what it is that she mentions. And Nate's like, well, I'm not going to answer that. Like why he's acting a certain way or whatever. And he's like, yes, I'll marry you. I love you. Like, it's just the next best thing to them actually talking about what's going on between them. It's crazy to watch, to the previous point, like we saw the little like escalation in their passive aggressiveness. And this is like an escalation of a horrible idea that
it's almost like a game of chicken. Like,
who's
going to call the bluff that this is not really happening?
They thought it was an exercise in improv, and you can't say no.
Yes. Improv. And right.
Yes. Yeah. And I will marry you. Let's do it right now. Like, it's so crazy.
Yeah. This starts with Nate asking, and like, you know, the Emily Priven funeral kind of runs throughout this episode. And it's like this wonderful sort of thing that everybody, all of the Fishers sort of project their own fear of loneliness and abandonment and being alone onto this woman in different ways, which I thought was really effective and very fascinating. And Nate asks Brenda if they have as much intimacy as she wants, to which she completely deflects and says, I don't have as much of anything as I want. Nate says, that's not much of an answer. And she says, well, it wasn't much of a question.
This is crazy. What are we even talking about? Like, she's basically saying, I don't have much of anything that I want. It's like, I don't even give answers that other people want because I don't have much of it. Like, this was in a giant sea of weird conversations that they have had. This is probably the weirdest. It's like bizarre to watch it happen in real time.
And we know, because she's talked to Melissa, that she doesn't feel like they have the same intimacy that they used to. Mm-hmm. And instead of answering the question to deflect, she asks him to marry her because she found her grandfather's fraternity ring.
What's more patriarchal than that?
And then Nate says, like, I wasn't expecting that.
She doesn't really ask. It's like the most passive question.
She says, be my wife.
Yeah. When he says, like, even that, it's like a joke.
No, it's a joke. And he's like, is that a no? Sincere. And he says, well, it's kind of an ugly ring.
Yes, Nate, get her.
Oh, one for the ages. But then, like, I don't know. There's something about Nate. Like, you know, she says she doesn't know what she'd do if she lost him. And he's like, and then he's kind of like, yeah, of course I'll marry you. I love you. I love you. Yeah, let's get married. It's like so weird. And now they're getting married. Allegedly.
What? Allegedly, supposedly. Like, I don't see how either of them come out of this conversation feeling like something positive was accomplished. I guess, yes, they're quote unquote getting married as far as they're both concerned, as much as we know. And like, how could anyone feel good about how this went down? It couldn't be any less, any more like vague and just strange, like I said. And like, poor Nate, if you're thinking about just his side of it for a second, he's like, okay, I may die. Maybe this is a good idea. Like, let's get married.
No, I mean, the only thing that these two characters are more afraid of than being alone is actually being together. Like, they're so afraid of their loneliness, but they're also even more afraid of vulnerability and intimacy. And like that tension, like I said, like this game of chicken playing out between the two of them was like, are we going to die alone and miserable, or are we going to just force each other to spend time with each other, like with a distance between us that we never penetrate? It's like,
like, I love
pick your poison on this given day. Like, Brenda found a ring, so I guess they're going to get married.
I guess the universe is sending me a sign. Like, it's either this or sex work. So I guess I choose this.
Well, the thing that I really thought with the happy coincidence of me remembering almost nothing from this show is like, oh, she's going to tell him that she's going to be a prostitute or that she's going into sex work. Like she's going to tell him about the thing with Melissa.
Right. I thought at least she was going to tell him about the incident. Yeah.
And then she's going to be like, deal with this, Nate. Like I'm a lady of the evening now. Like that was where I thought the jumpiness was going. And I think that that's intentional with the writing that we think she's going to go down this one path and nobody sees this coming. Nobody sees this.
Not certainly not Brenda, not Nate, like nobody, nobody knew that this was going to happen.
It's like the meme. Nobody, absolutely Brenda. Nobody. Brenda, Nate, will you marry me?
No. Will you be my wife? Like, it's so condescending. In a way, like, and her, what she believes like a quote unquote wife means, and to put him in that category is, oh my God, it's so rich and also incredibly bizarre, like I keep saying. And I don't know what to do. I don't, like, as a viewer, I'm not even in this, and I'm like, I don't know what to do with you. I don't know what to do for you. I want to help you, Nate. Brenda kind of also, but like, I don't know what to do.
Because Nate is like so, I mean, I was thinking when I was watching this episode that the show is getting a lot out of Nate's like meditations on mortality and whether his life is meaningful. And it's sort of impressive that it continues to reflect on those themes. And like, yes, the themes are so rich, but it continues to work with those themes without it retreading the same territory or getting stale, at least in my opinion. I'm continuing to enjoy that. And the Emily Priven funeral really, you know, sticks with Nate. It obviously makes an impact on Ruth. I think those are the characters for whom it has like the most impact. We also see interesting stuff from Rico and Claire and David. In response to Emily Priven lying alone. But we really know nothing about this woman aside from the fact that she keeps Wheat Thins in her refrigerator, which is psychopath behavior. That's crazy.
She likes them cold. You have no words.
No words. No corporal form and no words. No.
This is just how it goes sometimes. Mm-hmm. It is. I love that point that you made because I agree. On a lesser show, we would have been so tired of this version of Nate kind of being like this in-between space and like very, very slowly certain members of his family are finding out and it would get so old so quickly. And here it's like they could be in this space for the rest of the season and somehow it feels and somehow like make it work and make it, most importantly, like emotionally compelling. It's crazy. I do just want to shout out though how I love Nate's brain sometimes, and he's like, maybe I do know this song, and it's like, what if I sang the punk semi-punk version of this song? And I was like, oh my God, am I back at Webster Hall watching Taking Back Sunday, or is this just Nate? Because I didn't hate it, I have to say.
Love that. Yeah, no, it's so fun because we get these like dream musical sequences. We've had them from David a couple times. We had that. I think we had one from Claire, or maybe Claire and Ruth were just backup dancers. But I love when the show does these, and this is our first time we see Nate. And of course, it's not show tunes and sequence. It's going to be like his punk rock like performance of this.
He's got the sideburns for it.
But he does say he hates the crappy song.
He's like, after listening to this song like for three times over or whatever, I've decided I don't like the song, which is annoying. I love the scene earlier where David sang to him. He's like, oh, you don't know the song?
It was so cute. And David, then he gets a little carried away, and then he notices what he's doing, and he like reins it back in. We've all been there. We've all been there.
I did it at the beginning of the podcast. I live there. it's really interesting to watch Nate go through all this, as we keep saying. And like, again, Detective Claire, she's like, sees him, she's like, hey, are you okay? Because your eyes look kind of weird. And she's not being, to her credit, she's being kind about it. Like, she's clearly worried, but she's not being overbearing the way like Ruth would be. she's just like checking in on her brother, who she obviously is worried about.
Yeah, it's very, very sweet. Yeah, but like like Nate is sort of dealing with this, like, why would this woman be alone? Like, was she secretly like an asshole? Like, was she a terrible person, or is this what she wanted? And it's like very much Nate grappling with his own fears of being alone. And is he choosing to shut people out because that's what he wants? Or is there something that he's going to regret? Is he going to choke one day and die and have nobody at his funeral? I mean, it's like for these people who see funerals every day, who have funerals in and out of their house, like, of course you notice like, oh, there's ones that are filled with family and loved ones. And then there's this funeral that nobody goes to. There are no mourners. Like, she had her wishes. Was this really what she wanted? Or is she like Ruth, who's going to be terrified of ending up with this outcome?
Yeah, it's so sad to see Ruth like that at the end. But to the Emily part of it, I think it's so interesting to watch Nate go through, I mean, all of them in different ways, but Nate, I think, especially go through the different permutations of like, what if she was like this? What if she just, you know, was something, who was it? I think
was
it was David.
Autistic?
David was like autistic, and this is when he talks about Temple Grandin, like the high functioning thing.
I'm she just went in a machine at night that felt like a hug, and that was all the intimacy she needed. Yeah, to this, Claire has like a great moment where she says, I don't know why a person has to be labeled as mentally ill just because she had a life that doesn't conform to your image, to the image in your head. Maybe she had the life she wanted, a life without the hassles of other people. And Ruth has this outburst like, what kind of life is that?
Ruth, always speaking fiercely from her eye. That's how it goes for her.
Ruth is continuing with her the plan psychobabble throughout this episode. She's so rude to David. She says, like, if somebody moved into your neighborhood and renovated the house across the street, then you might feel like your house is a little bit shabby. To which David says, did you just insult me?
It's so interesting that they kind of pick up in a way from that conversation in the last episode where he was insulted by her outwardly, whether or not she understood it that way. And then now he's like, wait, did you just like extra more thinly veiled insult me?
Thinly veiled, just like Nate always wanted to be.
And then she's like, no, of course not, like you said. But it's we're all with David, like, kind of doing the Parvati face on Traitors, like,
oh my goodness, the Parvati face. Yes, no, the squinting and side eye abounds in this. I mean, of course the children are being like a little bit rude and diminishing to Ruth by laughing at all of the plan language that she's using. Like, of course you can fully understand this as like, you know, being an adult child of a parent that we definitely like, you have to eye roll from time to time.
It keeps like pain.
But Ruth is being like super sanctimonious about like, I'm in this program and I have my life together. But then we see like in her fantasy in this episode that she like, maybe she's rebuilt her house and her house is in like excellent working order and it's structurally incredible, but the house is empty. Like, whatever work she thinks she's done, it's not addressing the thing that was really bothering her to begin with. And she says it at the end of the episode when she gets her three children together. You know, she asks them, did any of you wonder why I wanted to rebuild the structure of my life? Did you even care? And she says that she doesn't want to end up like Emily Priven. Life's hard enough without people to help you through it. And when Nate says, like, Mom, you have us, she says, no, I don't. And, you know, Nate's been walking around like a zombie for months. Okay, that's fair. But did you ever ask him why? She said, David's lying down in the middle of the day. Like, okay, one day? He can't have like one day of being like, this is out of pocket. Like, this is no, like, David, like, you can't give David shit for having like one afternoon where he's out of sorts. And then he says, you know, that she can't even look in Claire's direction without it being this big imposition. And she demands, give me intimacy. Nate suggests that that should happen more organically. And she says, fine, I guess I'll keep waiting for it. Like I have been, I just pray it happens before I die. And it's just, this is just so emotionally manipulative and passive aggressive and needy and self-involved. And like we do, Ruth is a lonely woman, and that is, there is a sadness about that. And I do think she's a sympathetic character, but the way that she's so solipsistic in this self-focus when her children are struggling. And as I'm saying this, I'm like, okay, well, this is somebody who dedicated her life to raising a family, to being a supportive partner for her husband. Her husband dies. Like, it's the classic bind that women and mothers are in, where like they neglect themselves and then they're bitter about neglecting themselves and then they're selfish for focusing on themselves. It's like very tough, I think, to thread this needle. But like Ruth, I think, is especially in relationship to Claire, who is still like a literal child who lost her father and has been going through like all, she's also taking the SAT. It's like this, it sucks to be in high school. Like this is all really hard and Claire is going through it and she's tried at moments to connect with her mother. But Ruth is really incapable of doing this if it's not on her terms. And shouting, give me intimacy in the middle of your foyer after forcing your children to attend a stranger's funeral is like not the best way to go about this.
Yeah, I think the Claire part of it is interesting because, and there's a little bit of what you're talking about, her age and her being in high school, but like, that's just kind of how Claire is going to be at that age. Like, I can't look at you without being an imposition. Yes, that's called being a teenager. That's like what is going to happen. Like, I don't, it's not,
not
fun.
With my children, Ariel.
It's not fun for everyone. That's so funny because as I'm saying it, I'm thinking about my niece and nephew and I'm like, please, no, please. Oh God, anyone but you. Thankfully, there's a lot of time before that. But the Nate thing, like Nate, and this is a moment where Nate's empathy shines through a little bit where he's like, okay, okay, I see that you're trying, even though you're very your delivery is way off, but I understand what you're trying to say and what you're trying to achieve. This is, this kind of thing just has to happen a little more organically, and you know, it's like faint praise to call that kind, but I think it is, he at least he's the one out of the three of them that like is trying to connect with Ruth after she has bared her soul in this way, however, you know, inappropriately it came out, which I agree. It's like, it's so, from a mother after they lost their dad, it's just like, oh God, I get it. You need us, but like, we have our lives and you have to try to meet us where we are. Where's the part? Where's the part in the plan where you like leave your house and you go to their house? You're always talking about their house. Go to their house and go see what
they visit. Like. Bring cookies or something. Well, that So the plan stuff, and you know, the plan stuff is tough to take. At some point, David says, like, we don't think it's crazy, we just think it's weird.
Like, like way too honest again, but very realistically, like a child speaking to a parent.
So that's Ruth's outburst here. It ends with her, like the episode ends with her, you know, crying and looking at their baby pictures. And I always do like love when you get the actor's baby pictures and you get to see like, oh, that's little Laura Ambrose.
Right. Like, I see. I'm like, oh, I can see it. That's little David.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting to me that like an episode that I started the podcast by saying is like one of the funnier ones in my memory, certainly most recently in the run, ends on this like super, super pretty bleak note of Ruth just like feeling all of her feelings and all of her worries have come to light because of Emily Priven.
Yeah. Yeah. We still have Claire to talk about. And
yes.
Oh boy, Claire is taking the SATs. She's studying really hard. Parker is not. Parker is rating the effability of all the male teachers. Now, Ariel, I need to know, all right? Let's hear the full critique of, is it Gary's buns?
Yes. First, there's I have to place, ask you.
There's a Barry's buns in my neighborhood. They sell cinnamon buns. It's like the best cinnamon buns in town. So that's Gary's hilarious. Buns makes me think of Barry's buns. But go ahead.
I have to ask you first, though. Do you think Mr. Griffith's forearm hair is hot? Because sometimes it's unkempt.
It's unkempt.
I can't really tell. That's like, so I crazy really, like the I, little it's like showing like ankle like when you're wearing a dress like oh my god this like it's so untoward this thing
if you
so
saw ridiculous. If you saw my husband you would know I'm not one to speak about unkempt body hair
but back to speaking of butt back to Gary
Gary's buns.
I will say that probably in the grand scheme of other teachers and, you know, the fit of the pants isn't helping.
No, it was 2002. This was the worst era.
I'm not holding pants. Right. I'm not holding like the fashion in particular against him, but the fit is unfortunate for his figure. I think he has more of an ass than it seems like.
Okay.
But I think it's like, you know, ass in a sea of no ass, if that makes sense. There's so much no ass, but like the littlest glimpse of ass, you're like, wow, the ass. But like Parker hasn't met Nate, and that's all I'm gonna say. Because there have been shots, I haven't been called this before because I'm trying not to be like I don't know who would be like this, a Brenda about it, I guess. But like there are specific shots where they just like Nate turns around and the camera just sits there. And I'm like, oh, you know exactly what you're doing 6 feet under, Alan Ball. I know exactly what this is. I'm not falling for this. My house is very intact and I welcome Nate into my house.
To be fair, we don't see Gary in his like jogging outfit.
Yes.
The way we see Nate, but like, yes. Yeah, I agree that it's or like jeans, a little bit like flat. We don't
better get fitting jeans.
Better fitting jeans. Okay. Well, that was great, Ariel. Thank you for that critique.
This is why I'm here.
Mrs. Parker really needed you at that library table.
I would have pushed Claire off of the chair. Like, Parker, listen to me.
Like, let me see that list. Okay.
No.
How many teachers are at this school if, like, we're getting into the ranks of, like, 22 and Claire's like, that's pretty good?
Yeah, right. That's crazy. Like this, it does seem
like hundreds of male teachers,
like a small city. Like when you look, I'm trying to think of like the few exterior shots and some of the more interior shots that we've seen of the school. It does seem pretty big now that we're talking about
LA public school. I mean, I don't know. That's not where I'm from.
That's not the kind of doctor that I am.
I didn't have 22 effable male teachers in high school. I'll tell you that.
No, I did have a, I didn't have a lot. I was going to say I did have a lot of male teachers, but I don't know that I would call. It's hard to look back now, but I mean, it was a small city. It was like 4,000 kids.
Wow.
But total. But not my list would not have been as long. I'll tell you that.
So the big thing that Claire is dealing with in this episode is I guess it's all coming out in her sessions with the guidance counselor. Like she's starting to be much more involved in school and taking the SATs, which we know that she was like, I'm not going to college. And she like has been sort of obsessed with the idea of like forging her own path, like not doing what everybody expects of her. She like sees that as a cop out. And I love all of this stuff from Claire because it's like, she's such a precocious 17-year-old who's like not as smart as she thinks she is, but is like really, really smart.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's written so well that she's not a parody. And you hear
unlike
her.
Unlike
Parker, who is not written particularly well and is, as Claire says, you're a parody of yourself.
Yeah, that's rough.
I love how Claire just says these things to Parker and she just doesn't care.
Yeah, Parker's like, whatever. It's in that sense, to Claire's credit, she has always been very honest with Parker. She was, whether she was calling her a danger slut or like some kind of wonder slut or, you know, just judging her very openly.
Whatever modifier to slut.
Yeah. judging her to her face, Claire cannot be accused of being dishonest with her.
No. Claire is not fake. Claire is for real all the time. She's the genuine article. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as she's starting to invest more in her future, like Gary points out, and this is very good. I think he's mm-hmm. very astute yeah. that there's this fear of failure if she really does try to invest in her future. This idea of the fluorescent light showing who mm-hmm. you are and all of your pockmarks and scars. And
is there, are there fluorescent lights in the basement of the Fisher funeral home? Like, was that like a piece of it? Like, she has seen like
she's
the
seen
actual...
it. I mean, Rico really needs the light so that yeah. he can do his work. That's right. Like, you need to see all those little scars. So she starts to like sabotage herself or become obsessed with somebody else as a way of distracting from that fear and avoidance. And he's doing good work. He's pointing this stuff out. And amidst all of this, like Parker introduces this idea of effability and that she's going to seduce Gary. She thinks that she could like, what did she say? I could bag him big time or something.
Not just small time, big time. Big and this time. Is like a retaliation move against Claire, who's pissed at Parker for the, you know, SAT identity swap thing. Mm-hmm. So it's like extra messed up that she's like, oh, I'm going to sleep with your guidance counselor because you're mad at me. Like, it's what?
And this is where Gary loses me a little Oof. Bit.
Wait, before right before that, I love the scene. This is one of the things that made me laugh so much when she's like throwing the stuff at the wall. Mm. And he's like, this is amazing. This is great. I've never seen you so fired up. And he's like genuinely happy to see her show emotion. And then he's like, wait, not that. My nephew made that. So funny. Mm-hmm. And then at some point Parker has, because this is where my theory comes into play, and I'd love to hear what you have to say. We're like, Parker I think he still has to make the bad judgment call of saying this to Claire, what you're about to say, but mm-hmm. I think there was a little bit of inception from Parker in this off-camera conversation that Parker had with Gary.
Yes. Definitely. And Claire brings up Parker mm-hmm. and it's like what Claire is saying is like, oh, if you're going to F Parker, mm-hmm. then you better wear a condom because she probably has hepatitis C at least. and this is like, and then, you know, and then Gary says this like thing is like, oh, you know, young women talk to me, like they approach me, it happens. I'm like, okay, Gary, get over yourself. Yeah.
This is already going down a bad road.
And then he addresses the sexual tension between us. He says it's a normal part of transference, countertransference. Do you have anything you would like to contribute? And Claire's just like, no, I do
not.
So, okay, so what Gary is talking about with transference and countertransference is something that does happen. I'm not going to say often, but it happens in relationships, in the therapeutic relationship. It's actually like the term transference comes from the Freudian tradition and the idea of addressing and dealing with transference and countertransference is central to certain types of psychotherapy, like psychodynamic oriented psychotherapy, and transference are the feelings that a client transfers onto the therapist. So often it's used to talk about romantic feelings, but it could even be like maternal feelings or, you know, like friend. It could be, you know, and it's the idea that you have this kind of safe person that you can project whatever feelings that you might struggle with being open to in other relationships in your life, like that the therapist is a safe place for that to happen. Right. And then counter transference is acknowledging that the therapist will often project feelings back onto the client that are in part related to their own issues and are in part a reaction to the transference relationship. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of therapeutic approaches where the therapist might acknowledge that a transference countertransference is taking place. I would say that in the case of a guidance counselor that is treating children and adolescents that you don't acknowledge that there is a sexual tension happening in the relationship for a variety of reasons. And it's like, it would be one thing if Gary decided to address what Claire had said about alleging that he was pursuing Parker and say, like, would that make you feel a certain way? Because it would mean that maybe, like, your friend, I was giving attention to your friend instead of you, and like talking about it in ways that are not as like sexually valence. Like, I think that that might have been an appropriate thing and a difficult thing to handle. And I bet like that Gary might have had situations in the past where one of his students has said something like, oh, you're the only one who understands me, like, and has expressed romantic feelings for him. So it's not to say that like this is like a taboo thing that like is not on the table. But given like what Claire has been bringing to this, like, I just think he took this up to 11 in a way that he did not need to. And that like it could have bad consequences in two ways. It could be Claire like feeling uncomfortable because now she feels like sexually or romantically objectified by him in some way that wasn't coming from her, and that could drive her away. Or it could incept in the idea that there is some sort of romantic spark between them and that she should pursue it. And like both of those things would be bad, and that's why this is like super delicate. And I think like the way that he brought this up was really clumsy. He was probably bringing a little bit more of his own counter transference into this than he ever should have.
Get him. Get him, Amanda. That's what I'm saying.
Otherwise, I think he's been like really, really good. And it's like, gosh, Claire needs it. Like Claire needs like a stable, reliable adult person. Oh, so Gary, I don't like you, this is I don't care about like, you know, the buns are not going to make up for this. This is this was a misstep.
Yeah, big blunder. I agree. And it's so hard, to your point, to watch him be so wrong about something when he's been so right and so helpful, most importantly, and so important to her growth most recently, and like having an outlet, especially everything that happened with Gabe. Like there's a way in which he has saved her, like, you know, that sounds like maybe up to the 11 that he's taking this thing to, but like it's a very, very delicate time, full stop, for her because of everything that has happened to her, plus her age. And then for you to, and that's why I had my theory about like the Parker conversation, like whether she said something like, oh, I know you're Claire's guidance counselor, that's kind of hot. Right. Like, however she, whether very openly, like made some kind of accusation that, you know, Claire wants to sleep with you, but I do, or just bringing up Claire and then her being sexual with him. Like there are all these ways in which she could have sent him down this road. And it is, in my opinion, irresponsible, if that is the case, of like him to allow a separate conversation that he had with this person who is actually his, you know, client, student, and like Parker isn't at all. So like, why would you let that affect it? I agree. The way he brings it up is so clumsy and awkward and horrible. And most of all, in my opinion, whether this matters or not, this wasn't coming from Claire at all. Like, to your point about explaining so beautifully and clearly transference and counter transference, like there's a way in which maybe she had it and didn't realize it. And that's okay. Whatever. She's not a monster. But there was no, in my estimation, clue or like any flag, any red flag that was apparent in her behavior towards him. If anything, she was reluctant to open up to him. And there was a way in which like he had finally achieved her being open, whether it was the throwing or talking about her life in a certain way. And now he just like ruined it. I was like,
maybe the reason that Claire brings up Parker and is upset about it is because she's jealous. Maybe. But maybe the reason she brings it up is because the idea that Gary is corruptible and would sleep with a high school student makes him not the safe person that Claire needs him to be. And like by saying we have sexual attention, like then he becomes like not safe to her.
Yeah. And all these other, and just like all these other people that she is right to not trust, like the guy that Parker was sleeping with when they went on that fake camping trip, like all these people who have fallen for her idiotic whims, and just like, it's so disappointing. I agree. I really think, and we don't know. And again, it's one of those things on the show that like, we don't know. So it's interesting to kind of consider, but to me, it is exactly the latter, what you said. And she's just like, oh, wow. So you're just like everyone else. And that's so disappointing.
Right. And like, and Parker is also like becoming this thing that like, she ruins things. Like she ruins the hiking trip. She ruins Gary. She ruins the SATs by showing that everything is like bullshit and you can't trust it. Like anything that Claire's trying to do in a genuine, heartfelt way, Parker ruins it. So that was really disappointing, Ariel. But the rest of the episode, I mean, it's disappointing. I'm disappointed in Gary, but I'm thrilled with 6 feet Under.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, the fact that it's making us feel all these powerful emotions is to its credit, even as infuriating as some of these characters are acting, whether it's Keith yelling at Taylor or Gary being a butthead here. He's King Butthead in this
episode. Oh, wow. Maybe he doesn't have Nate's butt, but he does have Nate's
but
butthead.
He can take the throne, at least for this one episode from him.
Well, that's amazing. So we'll be back next week talking about episode 6 of 6 Feet Under, season 2. Ariel, until then, where can people keep up with you?
6-6. I didn't even consider that. I am covering movies every week with Grace Leader. We are covering Argyle this week, which, woof, that movie. We have a lot to say. Meow. There's a cat involved. Yes. Just wow. Like a lot of missteps and curious choices, but not boring ish for the most part. And then also covering Masters of the Air with DM Philly, aka Rich, every week. And that's on Apple TV Plus, and that's like just, I think, like 3 episodes. This week will be the 4th episode in like a 9 episode season. So look out for that. What about you?
I am covering True Detective Night Country, and this is a fast season and we are flying through it. We're going to have the penultimate episode releasing on Friday because of the Super Bowl on streaming. It's going to be on HBO on Sunday night, but on Max on Friday. It's been
Thank you, Super Bowl.
It's been a great season. It's had a lot of rich content to get into, and I've been talking about it with Grace Leader, so you can keep up with everything that I'm doing on X, where I am at Dr. Amanda R. That's Dr. Amanda R. And Ariel, you and I will be back next week talking about 6 Feet Under Season 2, Episode 6, In a Place of Anger. And until then, dear listeners, rest in peace.